Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. On the show today, we will hear from Keith Morgan from Storey County Emergency Management. He'll be talking about safety during the winter season, both in your car and at home. Pat Schlarbaum will bring us an update on climate action with Carolyn Raffensperger. And, of course, we will be recognizing Veterans Day. But before we get started, I want to remind you that it is KHOI's fall membership drive. So we are asking you to consider all that Local Talk and KHOI provide to you and the community. Think about the news, the people stories, the animal stories, the funny and the sad, the bloopers and the music. If you value all of that, or for that matter, any of that, now is the time to step up and become a member. Basic membership is $55, and the easiest way to donate is to go to the website, khoifm.org, and click the donate button on the left-hand side. It is quick and safe and secure, and once you do it, we will be happy to say welcome to the KHOI family and thank you. Also, I want to highlight that tonight we have another of our special Pantorium sessions that we hold about once a month, but more frequently during the fundraising drive. So tonight we have Gin Eric and the Off Brands, a five-piece folk, rock, and jam band that you can hear live in KHOI in the station. 7 to 8 p.m. tonight. Everybody's welcome. 410 Douglas, if you don't know where we are. The Pantorium building. So let's go ahead now and start the show with news from Dennis Hart.
Thanks very much, Gail. As always, it's great to be here on this Monday. The biggest story around the state of Iowa last week involved election returns. You likely already know who won, so we'll only spend a short time here recapping the results. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds defeated her Democratic challenger Fred Hubble in the closest gubernatorial race in 62 years. In Iowa Congressional District 4, which includes Ames, incumbent Republican Steve King defeated his Democratic challenger J.D. Scholten by about 10,000 votes. King won his ninth term in office. Elsewhere around the state, Democrat Abby Finkenauer defeated Republican incumbent Rod Blum in Congressional District 1. Democratic incumbent Dave Loebsack won his seventh term in office by defeating Republican challenger Chris Peters in Congressional District 2. And Democrat Cindy Axne defeated Republican incumbent Dave Young in District 3. Axne and Finkenauer become the first women to represent Iowa in the U.S. House of Representatives. Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate won his third term as Iowa's top elections official, defeating Democratic opponent Deidre DeGeer. Iowa's Treasurer, Democrat Mike Fitzgerald, won his 10th term in office, beating Republican Jeremy Davis. He is the longest-serving state treasurer in the nation. Democrat Rob Sand won the race for state auditor, and Republican Mike Naig won the post of Iowa's Secretary of Agriculture. In state legislative races, Republicans kept control of the Iowa House and Senate. When the state legislature convenes in January, GOP lawmakers will hold a 54-46 margin over Democrats in the House and a 36-18 margin in the Senate. A record 44 women will be serving in the upcoming state legislature, 33 in the 100-member House and 11 in the 50-member Senate. One more election-related note last week, word that a southern Iowa county attorney accused of being drunk in a courtroom lost her bid for another term in office. Clark County Democratic incumbent Michelle Rivera lost to Republican Adam Ramsey. The 42-year-old Rivera was charged with public intoxication after a sheriff's deputy saw her slurring her words and stumbling on her feet in a courtroom last month. There was more political news involving Iowa last week. President Trump named Iowa native Matt Whitaker as the acting U.S. Attorney General after Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigned. Whitaker is a former U.S. attorney in Des Moines. He was also the starting tight end for the Iowa Hawkeyes football team in the 1991 Rose Bowl. Whitaker grew up in Ankeny. Of course, there was news outside the world of politics in Iowa last week. Four people were killed in a plane crash in Guthrie County this past Friday after the pilot had a heart attack. The small plane had left Lamar's in northwest Iowa. It dropped off radar about 4 miles from the Guthrie County Airport and crashed into a pasture. Three of the victims were from Lamar's. One was from Merrill. It was the deadliest plane crash in Iowa since 2007, when a small plane crashed on approach to Council Bluffs Airport, killing all four on board. Another major story involving Iowa took place in California. A Southern California jury found a homeless man guilty of killing five people, four of them from southeast Iowa, by setting an abandoned Los Angeles building on fire. 24-year-old Johnny Sanchez was convicted of 5 counts of murder. He faces life in prison without parole. Also last week, word came that a class-action lawsuit against a former Iowa youth basketball coach and the club he co-founded could result in damages exceeding $10 million. That's what a lawyer for the plaintiffs said Monday. The lawsuit accuses former coach Greg Stephen of intrusion on his victim's seclusion. Stephen has pleaded guilty in federal court to 5 counts of sexual exploitation of a child, as well as transportation and possession of child pornography. He admitted to secretly recording players showering and undressing in hotel bathrooms. Also last week, an Iowa poultry and pork producer sued the meal preparation company Blue Apron for $26 million in damages. West Liberty Foods said Blue Apron failed to honor an agreement to absorb half the losses related to the purchase and operation of a company that supplied chicken for Blue Apron's meal kits at a below-market price. Blue Apron ships weekly boxes of ingredients and a rotating list of recipes to customers for them to make into meals. There was also word last week that a northeastern Iowa dairy that makes cheese had agreed to pay a $100,000 penalty. Prairie Dairy Farms had admitted violating air quality rules for a dozen years. Meanwhile, last week, Hy-Vee warned customers that a coupon circulating on social media was a hoax. The fake posting included an $80 off groceries coupon at Hy-Vee. The food chain said it's a scam and that Hy-Vee stores would not honor the coupon. There was also word that a Council Bluffs man had been arrested for allegedly sex trafficking a minor. The FBI detained 68-year-old Richard John Massey at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport when his flight from Mexico landed. Authorities said his alleged crimes took place, among other locations, in southern Iowa. Also last week, word that sheriff's deputies in southwest Iowa seized about 300 pounds of marijuana at a traffic stop along Interstate 29. The marijuana was found after a recreational vehicle was pulled over in Fremont County. Deputies said a police dog indicated the presence of drugs in the vehicle. A North Carolina man and 2 Virginia men were arrested. Last week also brought word that vandals had smashed the front windows of a nonprofit organization on Des Moines' north side. That organization, called the Watchmen Training Center, said its mission is to watch over humanity. It trains young people in self-defense and has a food pantry near its training center. There was also word that someone slipped a racist threat under the door of a student's dorm room at Drake University. The note read, in part, "We've decided that we no longer want you on our campus, which means you need to leave or else." The threat was made using a racist term. University officials denounced the note. Meanwhile, the Ankeny woman who tied her dog's mouths shut with bungee cords was put on probation. Alisa Andres had pleaded guilty to animal neglect. She was sentenced to probation and must pay $190 in fines, along with another $300 as terms of her probation. She said she had wrapped 2 of her dog's snouts with a cord to keep them from barking. And in another animal-related story, there was word that an emaciated dog was put inside a kennel and thrown into a dumpster in the River Bend neighborhood at 6th and Forest Avenues in Des Moines. Officials said a passerby found the dog named Oscar and took him to the Animal Rescue League. An Animal Rescue League official said the dog is, in his words, so sweet. He wants to be near people at all times and especially loves being held. Word also came last week that 3 years after construction began, Come and Go's new $150 million headquarters building on the western edge of downtown Des Moines is now open. The 6-story building at 1459 Grand Avenue has 159,000 square feet. About 300 employees now work there, but there will be room for at least 800 when it's fully occupied. A public tour of the building will be held from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday, December 1st. There was also word that Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines is expanding its occupational health services with the opening of a second location. The new clinic at 2525 East Euclid Avenue will have an open house from 4 to 6 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, then be open for business on Wednesday. Also last week, word that officials are considering building apartments at Merle Hay Mall in an effort to provide affordable housing for the mall's employees, attract new shoppers to the retail center, and address Urbandale's goal of bringing more family housing options to the city. The Merle Hay Mall has lost both Yonkers and Sears in recent months after the companies that owned them filed for bankruptcy. There was also word that a block of Court Avenue in Des Moines will close this week, starting today, Monday. Court between 5th Avenue and 4th Street will be closed for sewer work through this coming Friday. That section of Court Avenue sits directly east of the Polk County Courthouse. The Meredith Corporation also made news last week. The Des Moines-based publisher announced it was selling Fortune magazine to a businessman from Thailand. The purchase price? $150 million. Meredith has been looking for a buyer for Fortune and several other titles since it acquired the entire portfolio of Time Incorporated early this year. In September, Meredith announced it would sell Time magazine for $190 million. There was word last week of the death of the woman who owned the famous Field of Dreams near Dyersville. Denise Stillman had bought the property 8 years ago and founded Go the Distance Baseball, the company that operates the property. A company spokesman said it remains committed to the Field of Dreams, which was the location for the movie of the same name starring Kevin Costner. Also last week, we discovered the identity of the Iowa woman who had one of the two winning tickets in the recent big Powerball jackpot. She is Lauren West of Redfield, who bought a winning Powerball ticket from a Casey's General Store in Redfield. That ticket made her one of the two winners in a Powerball jackpot that had reached $687 million. The other winner bought a ticket in New York. Also last week, word that a Quad Cities area man who bought a Mega Millions lottery ticket in Davenport last month won $1 million. Bob Hollenbach says he plans to share his winnings with his family, take a trip, and buy some land. And of course, college football made news across Iowa this past weekend. Iowa State University kept its very fine football season going by defeating Baylor 28-14. But the news was not so good elsewhere. The University of Iowa lost to Northwestern 14-10, and the University of Northern Iowa lost to Youngstown 31-10. And that's your look at a busy, busy week of news across the state of Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking a deep breath now and reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday with a look at what makes news this week on the pages of the Ames Tribune. Between now and then, stay warm and have a great week.
You packed your bags and shut the door. You crossed the sea to fight a war. You didn't know just what would happen to you. Stepped in the dirt, boots on the ground, and gunfire was the only sound. And to yourself you whispered, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Every day and every night, you walk the walk, you fight the fight. You never saw the end in sight, now did ya? The tears are washing a haze of red, the blood, the mud, too many dead. Your weary soul was crying, hallelujah, hallelujah.
That was Sailor Jerry and a version of Hallelujah written for veterans. Today is Veterans Day, and it is a special commemoration this year because yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I on November 11, 1918. World War I was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and wouldn't it be wonderful if that had been true? But it wasn't, and a big concern today is providing care and support for veterans, both in terms of their physical and mental health. Ursel Rudenberg recently spoke with several people involved with veteran services. In particular, they talked about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and suicide. This conversation was broadcast in its entirety on Heart of Iowa in September, and we are playing excerpts from it today to recognize the challenges facing veterans as well as the resources available to support them. In this segment, Ursula is speaking with Barnett Devine, a counseling psychologist who works with veterans, and Keith Putney, a lawyer and farm owner in Boone who is also a veteran who experienced PTSD after the Vietnam War. Ursula asked about the symptoms of PTSD, and that is where we'll pick up the conversation.
First come to my mind is disruption of sleep and sleep disorder. nightmares or night terrors. Often physical responses go along with that, such as headaches, heart palpitation. Also, I think you see more and more avoidance behavior, so a withdrawal from social interaction and a significant amount of personal isolation. Another thing I think is mood swing, and they may be abrupt. PTSD patients often experience flashbacks, and those flashbacks can arouse other symptoms of PTSD, certainly one of the more significant symptoms. The person who is experiencing PTSD perceives it as normal, but internally is beginning to experience thoughts of suicide, feelings of guilt, feelings of shame, that kind of thing, as the social isolation increases. So the person continues to withdraw, then the symptoms continue to grow. The fight or flight, the panic attacks, the arousal system of the fight or flight may result in physical altercation, sometimes with spouses. On some occasions, individuals may become aggressive. Depression, anxiety, withdrawal, flashbacks, repression of memories, all of those are symptoms of PTSD, and all of those, along with things like emotional numbing, where a person tries to shut down their emotional response to charged experiences, all of those can lead to very serious and deep depression, and certainly relate that to thoughts of suicide.
When you initially come home, a lot of veterans have what I call survivor's guilt. They came home and a lot of their friends didn't. And they have a tough time dealing with why it was okay for them to come home and others did not. And that's a matter of reestablishing your sense of self-worth and finding a reason to get up and go on and make your life worthwhile, hoping that you live a good life that's worthwhile because you're here and others aren't.
Feeling guilt, often associated with shame, is one of the issues that expands the diagnosis well beyond the combat experience. So guilt and shame are often a strong component of PTSD.
What was important for you to help the recovery process?
Creating an atmosphere of acceptance and creating an experience of affirmation of their worth. Along with that, paying attention to someone's physical health is important. Many times, as people have gone through these emotional experiences, they've also failed to care for themselves physically. Certainly, if it was alcohol or drugs, abstinence, sobriety was the first thing because you pretty much can't do much while you're under the influence. As a treatment program, we're trying to always look first at sobriety, second, community, creating a sense of belongingness and helping people experience a sense of worth and then addressing their physical well-being. Then you move on to things such as vocational change, marital counseling. All of these things become important.
Did you find in your work that people were able to recover?
Absolutely. I'm always reluctant to use the word recovered, but they are certainly in recovery. People with PTSD who actively became involved in improved self-care and treatment absolutely become lifelong involved in the process. It was amazing to me what people can recover from. And the psychological strength that individuals demonstrated to me in their recovery is something that has always given me great hope for people in general.
Ursula Rudenberg and Keith Putney also spoke with Tyler Patterson, the suicide prevention officer with the Veterans Administration in Iowa. Here they are discussing veterans and the issue of suicide.
How does changing the language about suicide help to reduce stigma?
Well, starting a conversation about mental health or anything related to getting help for that, you've got to bring up stigma. People who are diabetic don't face a lot of stigma if they're going to get help for that, or if they have cancer or some other organic illness. And so we have to start thinking of mental health issues as being something that is chemical and organic and something that people need treatment for. Military service does not necessarily prepare someone to be really open to receiving help. So if you think about military culture, it's not one that would specifically prepare someone to say, I can't do this, I need help, and being able to reach out.
It's all about delivering.
Right, all about delivering. And so you talk about people who've been through military drills, military operations, and I would wager to bet that most of the time those things go over with a fair amount of perfection. And so you have people coming back not readjusting well, and feeling like they're failing at everything they're doing. Then you're sort of in they're double bound then, because then they've also been taught to not reach out for help. So that's where that kind of struggle really takes place. What we've tried to do nationally is start to change the language of how we talk about suicide. And it's a simple switch from no longer saying that someone has committed suicide to that someone has died by suicide or was lost to suicide. The pieces around that are parts that some people may not always think about, which is committed, number one, means you made a volitional choice. A lot of times when people attempt suicide, they're under the influence of something. If they're deeply depressed, they're not in a real place where they can give that kind of consent or make that type of commitment with any reliability. The other point about that is, up until the 60s in Britain and in the United States, a little later than that in some states, an act against the self was against the law. And if you survived a suicide attempt, you were in trouble. So we don't want to criminalize suicide. So that's why we're working on changing that language.
Can you talk a little bit about homelessness and what your role is in working with the homeless coordinators?
Sure. The VA continues to be very aggressive in dealing with veteran homelessness and the varying programs that are available. So we talked about the domiciliary, which was larger in Knoxville. It's a bit smaller in Des Moines, but still providing coping skills services to homeless veterans, veterans with substance use disorders, veterans with PTSD. And the programs that we have a program called HUD-VASH, which is HUD VA supported housing, which helps get veterans into their own apartment and living independently with a HUD voucher. And we also have the Grant Per Diem program, which gives veterans 2 years of rent-free accommodation, living in a communal veteran environment, which can also be very therapeutic, giving them time to get their mental health sort of managed, any substance use disorder sort of managed, and getting employed. And so then we have employment specialists that help veterans become employed and integrate them into the community. I can't quite remember how long ago it was, but we also have a Veterans Justice Outreach Officer that goes into the prisons and jails to, if veterans have broken the law and it's tied to their military mental health or substance abuse issues, to be able to help them get out of jail, be able to get the treatment they need and get back into society.
So it's an advocate kind of job that this person performs
veterans. Yes.
One of the issues that's out there, and you hear about this is a lot, what veterans need are good jobs, and good jobs provide, you know, part of their mental health, you know, in terms of feeling better about themselves and able to care for their families and everything that's related to those kinds of issues. Does the VA in Des Moines network with big businesses like the principals and the other businesses to place the veterans in some of those?
I can't speak specifically to the businesses that our supported employment department partners with, but I do know that they try their best to find jobs that go with veteran skills that they have and how much they can work. A lot of times in the area in mental health that I work in, sometimes the people that are in a recovery process can't do full-time work to start out. The other thing we need to talk about a little bit too, is the chronic pain issue that goes on in the veteran population, where you have very young people in their 30s with major physical injuries and limitations and things like that that perhaps don't allow them to work or work a limited amount. So we really try to tailor our employment opportunities and things like that around what really fits the veteran.
And speaking of resources and websites, let's talk about some of the hotlines that
yes.
are available.
So the National Veterans Crisis Line can be reached at 1-800-273-8255, Veterans Press 1. We have 3 national call centers. Our first one was in Canandaigua, New York. We've got one in Atlanta, Georgia, and most recently one in Topeka, Kansas. And how that works is veterans call that hotline. You have generally master's-level trained clinicians trained in crisis response 24 hours a day. You can also text into that service and also use a chat room. So the thing that's nice about the National Veterans Crisis Line, which I think has answered over 3 million calls and done over 1 million rescues, is you call the number, you talk with a clinician, they help you through an immediate crisis or send a rescue to your home, wherever you're at in the United States, and then we as suicide prevention staff get notified of that and then we reach out to the veteran to close any gaps that there may be.
So, Tyler, is this hotline available to spouses and others who have concerns about the veteran in their home or their son or daughter?
Yes, third-party callers can call the hotline and get support. And the hotline will even make a warm call to a veteran. If someone calls in a neighbor or a friend and says, hey, I'm worried about my friend. He's a veteran down the street. They'll even try to reach out to them that way. So it's a very nice system.
And my last word is, when you see somebody walking around in a veteran's hat or a coat or whatever, tell them thank you for their service. They really appreciate those kinds of comments.
Thanks to Ursula Rudenberg for that conversation, which reminds us about the great respect we should show our veterans, not just today, but all year long. She was speaking with Keith Putney, Tyler Patterson, and Barnett Devine. This is Local Talk on KHOI on day 6 of our fall membership drive. So if you have not yet donated, what are you waiting for? Now is the time to do it. Also keeping us current on important topics, Pat Schlarbaum talked with Carolyn Raffensperger for an update on climate action.
Okay, today on Local Talk, we're with Carolyn Raffensperger. Give me how you'd like for me to refer to you as attorney, member of Sierra Club, director.
Oh, you know, plain member of and citizen of this world. I am the executive director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, and I'm currently the chair of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you, Pat?
And let's delve into something that has been under, I guess the term would be litigation, but there's some climate change discussions going on, and kind of frame the situation, if you could, please.
Yeah, a bunch of kids got together and brought a lawsuit that argued that they had a right to a climate that was stable and where the government had actually taken action to protect a climate from unsuitable, inappropriate, preventable change. And so that particular lawsuit has had a lot of interesting ramifications, both politically and, of course, in the courts.
And I understand this has been going on for maybe a year and a half or so. And a lot, when we say kids, I think there's your young adults. The man that I'm most familiar with, Journey Zephyr, I think he's 17. But they are essentially a group of youth. And Journey's from Hawaii, but these people that have banded together are from all over the United States, correct?
That is actually true. But the lawsuit goes back earlier. So to set the stage, there was a strategy that looked at how we could catalyze change in the United States around climate change. How could we get state and the federal government to do something that was substantial and that met the kind of crisis that we know is coming with climate change? And so what happened is they developed a strategy around the country where children in almost every state, many states, brought a lawsuit in state court. And then there was a federal court case. And the case that I think you're referring to is this federal case. So we actually had a lawsuit in Iowa several years ago that was dismissed. So it was not allowed to go forward. They were using pro bono lawyers. Lawyers that act as a counsel free of charge. So a lot of lawyers around the country have been working on behalf of future generations and these kids to get the government to take action to prevent this preventable and unnecessary climate change. And in this particular case, the kids made an argument, so they're the plaintiffs, and the federal government is the defendant, being charged with not fulfilling its duty to protect life, liberty, and happiness, and that larger sense of happiness being the greater public good. So the kids have gone through a number of hurdles in their litigation. And most recently, the case that they've brought with the Justice Department defending the United States was challenged in the Supreme Court and said that they didn't have a legitimate basis to go forward. And this is the second time that the Supreme Court had to rule on the procedural status of the case, meaning did they have grounds to go forward? Was it in compliance with the Constitution? Were there any grounds for stopping this particular case? And the current administration, the Trump administration, didn't want this case to go forward, did not want to be held accountable for not fulfilling its duty to future generations, and appealed to the Supreme Court to throw it out and stop it from going to trial. And it's currently slated to go to trial very soon. And for the second time last week, the Supreme Court allowed it to go forward. So now that case is going to trial, and the kids are going to argue two things. The lawyers on behalf of the kids are going to argue two things.
Will this be at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., or is there it will be taking place in Oregon?
It'll be taking place in a lower court. So you have a federal district court, you have an appeals court, and you have the Supreme Court. And this will be held in the lower federal court. But
where at?
I think it's in Oregon, but I'm not sure.
Portland, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. There are actually a couple of other kids' climate cases being brought. But this particular federal case is arguing for an expansion of a really ancient and wonderful idea that applies primarily to rivers. And it's called the Public Trust Doctrine. And the idea is that the state of Iowa, or the state of Illinois, whatever the state may, Oregon, is the trustee of the shore and the river bottoms, and that you cannot deny access to commoners, people who share, the community members who share that, cannot deny them access, and they're responsible as the trustee to care for it. And this idea that government is the steward, the trustee, the caretaker of these common assets that we all hold together, that we share, is the basis for this lawsuit, arguing that the atmosphere should be treated like rivers. It should be treated as something that's essential for our well-being, and that these kids have a right to, you know, the healthiest and most stable atmosphere that we can provide for them. And the entity that provides for that is government. And in this case, they're arguing both that they have a right to that and that government has a duty to act to prevent harm to the climate. And so that's what's at stake here. And it's really wonderful litigation that I hope expands the idea of the public trust and galvanizes the federal court to take action in this case. It will be appealed eventually to the Supreme Court, but here's where we are at this moment.
And thank you so much for this analysis, Carolyn Raffensperger, in doing good work for the environment. Is there anything else, Carolyn?
Yes. The question that if this goes forward and they win is, what do they want the judge to do? So what would we like the judge to order the federal government to do? And so there's some very interesting things that they could do. They could, for instance, prevent any new permits given to drill for oil or gas in public lands or in oceans until there was a climate plan in place. I was part of a group that looked at the remedies, and that was one that I suggested. They could suspend all of those permits. Now imagine if we used an argument like that against Dakota Access Pipeline, which goes within a mile and a half of where you and I are sitting right now, Pat, and said you couldn't give a permit to Dakota Access until, so it couldn't cross the Mississippi River and it couldn't cross the Des Moines River under the Army Corps of Engineers jurisdiction until we had a climate plan in place. And then these permits could only be given if it actually met that climate plan. So it's a way of dealing with the threats to climate, but it also would allow us a way of thinking about many other assets that we share. I'd like to see it help us protect the rivers of Iowa. I'd like to see it protect our public lands. You know, we earlier in an offline conversation, we were talking about them fracking near a great national monument called Chaco Canyon. It might be a national park now, but that they're going to frack near these ancient ruins of the Puebloan people, and that's a travesty. The idea that if we protect climate, then we're likely to protect a lot of other things and restore them and enhance them. And one of the interesting things is, what standard should we use for any of these comments, especially the atmosphere or, say, Iowa rivers, under this idea that government is the trustee and has a fiduciary duty to take care of them? It's not just an ordinary run-of-the-mill duty. It is a unique kind of duty to care for, and a very stringent duty to care for these things. And that is, if we take care of one, we're more likely to take care of the others.
Including your voice with KHOY Community Radio, how important is this medium to Carolyn Raffensperger?
You know, radio has been a way of getting a shared perspective on issues. It's a way of elevating ordinary community members' voices. It is a way of deepening conversations. And all news is not national news. And many national issues have local implications. And this is a place where we can explore what is uniquely us, what is uniquely Iowan. You know, I think a morally mature culture tailors its culture to the place that we inhabit. So we think about climate, for instance. We were just talking about climate and a lawsuit about climate change. Differently in a place where we have fall. We're sitting right next to the Munn Woods. This is influencing the conversation as we speak. And so this conversation is back and forth between human voices and the place that we live. I hope that KHOI allows us to be that morally mature culture by helping us shape a relationship both with between humans and among humans and with the land itself.
That was Pat Schlaubaum speaking with Carolyn Raffensperger. Keith Morgan is with Story County Emergency Management, and he visited us at KHOI last week. As always, Keith had lots of useful information, this time about keeping us safe now that winter is here. So, Keith, as we all know, winter is upon us, and so there's a number of things that you've been doing to get ready for that. Can you tell us about one exercise that recently took place to help people out in winter?
Sure. A lot of folks have seen those gates that are up there by I-35 and Highway 30, and those gates are what will close off Interstate 35 between Ames and Mason City if there's some reason that the Iowa DOT feels that it's unsafe for travelers to continue north. We have a plan in place to be able to take care of motorists should the Iowa DOT close the interstate, which they've done pretty much once a year over the past few years.
And that could be for blowing and drifting snow, winds, actual snow accumulation, or if there's a snow-related accident, any of those things?
Any of those things. If the road becomes unsafe or if the road is impassable, then they'll go ahead and close it. Oftentimes, we don't get much of a notification that they're going to close it, so that's why we have a plan put together to rapidly be able to react to it and take care of those motorists. There's been times I've gotten a little bit of a heads up. There's been times that it's as they're closing it. So what we've done is we've put a checklist together that integrates a whole bunch of different partners across this area. We've involved Ames, Iowa State, our ham radio operators, Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, lots of different people. And the way that it works is either when I get the notification or one of our dispatch agencies, such as Story County Sheriff's Office or Ames, we go through this checklist, and it puts out signs to let the motorists know where to go to, and we take them off at Dayton so that they can take care of themselves. They can utilize those hotels that are in that area. The truckers, We've worked with Iowa State to try and make sure that the parking lots by Hilton Coliseum are plowed so that they can park their trucks there, keep them off of the smaller roads. Our ham radio operators will actually get on a CB and let the truckers know that the road's closed. We have also worked with Ames Visitors and Convention Bureau, and they will call around to all of the hotel rooms because come day to day, we never know how much hotel capacity we're going to have. And if they let us know that there's very few rooms, then we'll start working with the Red Cross and our rapid action team for sheltering to be prepared to open up a shelter to take care of these motorists if they do get stranded. The shelter is set up at the First Christian, so we'll have a place to get them out of the weather. We have arrangements with the Salvation Army to assist the Red Cross when it comes to actually doing the feeding if we need to do that. It's one big team that comes together and fills whatever gaps are there.
So you've run through kind of a dry run of this recently, is that right?
Yep. In the middle of the day, we did what we call a call down. We simulated that the call came into us. Each of us ran through our checklist to make sure phone numbers were correct and that everybody knew what to do. And we identified some phone numbers that have changed, or we included our rapid action team for sheltering. This was their first time, to make sure that we could contact them and move on through. We capture these, what we call after action items, and we go through and update the plan or do some more training if we need to make sure that it's ready to go at a moment's notice.
What happens at the other end? Do you know? The other end of the closure is in Mason City?
Yes. My counterpart has the same kind of a plan set up for there. And we've also talked about those motors that are in between the two gates when they go down.
That's what I was going to ask about next.
We in Story County at least have made arrangements, and the dispatch agencies know to contact the Red Cross if somebody has dropped off, let's say, either in Huxley or up in Story City, that may not have the capability to find shelter. We'll work with the Red Cross and make sure that folks in between get taken care of. It's a pretty wide open area, and it's important that anybody that's driving here in Iowa in the wintertime is prepared for the eventuality of being stuck and stranded out there as they're traveling.
So hopefully people are ready, but you do what you can to get them off the road when needed and get them to safe environments.
Yes, and that's it's good that we do get a little bit of notification, and we really appreciate the assistance that everybody gives us on this.
So that leads us to the next thing I guess we should talk about, which is being ready for winter driving.
That's, you don't want to think about this as the snow's coming down and you're at work or someplace like that. So I hope everybody right now is thinking about it. The skies are gray and there's that little white stuff coming down. And what they need to start off with is their car. Make sure their car is ready for the winter. And that means checking your tires that may have been okay back in the spring, but now there's a little bit more tread going on it. First off, make sure that you have tires that are suitable for the snow that's going to be coming. Check your battery and also your windshield wiper fluid. That slush that gets on your windshield is one of those ways that you could be involved in an accident because you don't have it cleared out.
Can you check your battery yourself, or do you need to bring that somewhere that they can check that it's powerful enough to get through the winter?
In the old days, you used to be able to check the fluids that were inside
right.
of them. Now that's not so easy, so take it on into either your
okay.
mechanic or one of the parts places. They'll put your battery under a load to check and see how much capacity it has, and that's a very important thing because
so you may have – it may have been fine all summer,
yep.
but suddenly it gets cold and no good.
Exactly.
Okay.
So get it checked out now before it's cold and, mm-hmm. and you're stranded out there. Other things are your tire pressure itself, as the air gets colder, is going to decrease. Get it back inflated. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, go open up your trunk, check that spare tire that you haven't looked at for years. Make sure that it's filled. I just about a month ago stopped and helped out a lady that her car had a flat, and her spare was also pretty much flat. Once you got your car up and running, make sure that you have a good windshield scraper. And don't do the porthole driving where you just scrape a tiny little hole that you're looking out of. Clean the entire windshield. Make it so that you're much safer out there driving. After that, once you get into the car, or even before you go out, the first question you always got to ask yourself is it worth it? Is this trip with the snow coming down, the roads icy and everything else really worth either damaging my car and having to have it in the shop or worse, injuring or killing yourself or somebody else? So start with that. Do good risk management before you even venture out to that car. If you are going to go out to your car, make sure your cell phone is fully charged before you ever get in the car. And when you sit down, check that fuel gauge. You shouldn't really be driving around out there with less than a half a tank of fuel at any time, because that fuel may be what keeps you warm and safe if you should happen to go off the road. Some other things, have some warm clothes. In fact, before you ever get in the car, dress like you're going to walk to where you're going to go. Mm-hmm. Because, again, you may think to yourself, oh, I don't need a thick coat. The car is
right,
nice
I'll
and warm.
Be in the car, yeah.
Until we have something mm-hmm. like what happened last year with the 70-car pile up there on I-35. And so make sure that you've got that sort of stuff in there. Make sure that you have something like a collapsible shovel so that if you do get a little bit stuck, you can shovel it out and get yourself out of there. A couple of candles can also keep you warm. If you do go into the ditch or something like that and you're way out in the middle of nowhere and there's nobody else to help you, then you need to consider whether you're going to run the car or not. Carbon monoxide poisoning is a real risk when you're sheltering in a car. So if you are going to run the engine, the most important thing is to make sure that the tailpipe is clear. Also, only run it for about 15 minutes or so out of every hour and crack the window slightly so that you don't keep warm but succumb to carbon monoxide poisoning while you're out there. If you do get into an accident like we saw on I-35, you have a choice to make. Do I stay with the car and stay warm, or do I abandon the car and move away from it because of the other cars going by? I can't tell you an answer right now what's the best thing to do, but if you're considering that, if there's still a lot of traffic on the road, if you are going to abandon your car, get it a long ways away from it. As we saw from the video, those accidents can happen, and you have people taking the ditch. So get as far away from that car as you possibly can if you're going to abandon it.
And if you're in a more rural area and you either get stuck or maybe you go into the ditch because you can't see the edge of the road, is it best to, in that case, to stay with your car rather than to try to walk if you're not sure where the nearest building or house or anything is?
The key you just said is if you're not sure where the nearest house is. You might see a house in the distance, but when you get up to it, you might find that it's an abandoned house and that there's nobody there. Or if the winds come up, you may lose your direction because the visibility does go down. Typically now with cell phone coverage that we have, that's why I said have a good charged up cell phone. Turn on that GPS location if you don't have it. Call 911. Let them know where you're at, and they'll get somebody else out there to help you. When you do start walking, a couple of years ago, unfortunately, we had an elderly couple north of here that tried to walk to a home, and they never made it there. So it's, again, it's a decision. You got to look around. If you can see a home with lights on really close by, then it might be worth it. But if you're not sure that there's help in a pretty close distance, it's probably better to stay with your car.
Now, I lived in Montana for a while, and we used to keep a can of Sterno in the car. You mentioned candles, but Sterno would serve the same purpose, give you a little extra warmth?
Exactly, a little bit of Sterno. And if there's more than one person in the car, it's not a time to be shy. Go ahead and share that body heat. Keep yourself warm because in Iowa, we'll probably be able to get to you within nothing more than a few hours, maybe a half a day at the absolute most. And you can, if you have made a few preparatory preparations for this kind of event, you'll be okay, but you got to do some thinking now so that you don't endanger yourself down the road. Other things that I'd like to get out right now, along with this, people are going to start using alternative heating devices in their house. If used properly, that's okay, but make sure that you're following the instructions. Make sure you have a good smoke detector and a good CO detector in your house. And never leave those devices unattended. Make sure that there's somebody there, an adult there watching it to make sure that nothing goes wrong with it and that it doesn't start a fire. Unfortunately, every winter we see that happening, and smoke detectors and CO detectors are absolutely essential for your own safety.
Are the new space heaters that they make safer?
They've incorporated a lot of safety features, the tip-over feature, so that if it tips over, it automatically shuts down. A lot of that stuff has made it safer. Make sure that it comes from a good quality provider, that it has something like a UL safety designation on it. All of those things are important. But even with those kinds of things, people may put them too close to curtains and things like that. The human has got to be a part of it too, to make sure that they're used safely. Definitely don't ever try and use charcoal or anything like that because of the carbon monoxide. Use things that are designed for it.
What kinds of other dangers do you see in winter?
Oh, there's lots of them. Just going outside, the yak's tracks or putting something on your shoe, slips and falls are the most
– broken bones.
Lots of broken bones, young and old alike. It's not just the old. So invest in those. But it doesn't do you any good to invest in them if you don't use them. Make sure that when that it's that kind of weather out there, put them on, use them. Take things slow and easy. That's in the wintertime. That's the most important thing, is to take it slow and easy and think about, is it really worth it? I love being outside in the wintertime, but you just got to think ahead before you do that.
Yeah, I also like being outside in winter, and just find that if you dress for it and you're ready for it, it can be a wonderful experience, that it can be lovely.
Exactly. After a snowfall or something like that, but dress warmly. Let people know where you're going just in case you fall, you hurt yourself, so that they can go and locate you quickly and get you back to safely.
So if we get lots of snow or a heavy snow, how should people approach that in terms of clearing snow?
Well, again, make sure that you're properly dressing for it. That's a great time for the yak tracks and stuff like that. Take it slow and easy, again, especially if it's that wet, heavy snow. We see a lot of an increase in heart attacks and things like that when people are shoveling. Be a good neighbor. If you have somebody that's next to you that's elderly, especially if you have a snowblower, offer to do it for them. Most of the time, they're going to say they're too proud for it, but if you just get up in the morning and you just happen to have to do a little bit more, which is their sidewalk and like that, that's a really great thing to do. But make sure that you take it as slow and easy. It's usually very cold and blustery afterwards. Watch out. Have that full face protection against frostbite as the snow is out there. Take it easy. But it's important that if you do have a sidewalk, to get it cleared so that people can safely walk as they're enjoying the wintertime.
Right. I know in Ames it's the homeowner's responsibility to clear the sidewalk. I imagine it's that way in most surrounding towns as well.
Yeah, most towns do have an ordinance that within a certain amount of time. And also, when it comes to clearing the roads, they may have snow ordinances. Check with your city to see what the snow ordinances are. Yeah. They're not doing it just because they want to. It helps them get those roads cleared quickly so that first responders can get to where they need to go. Another thing is when you're shoveling that snow, if the snow gets deep, if you've got a fire hydrant that's out in front of your house or just down the street, help out your firefighters and help out yourself, help out your neighbors. Go and shovel the snow away from it so they can find it quickly, access it, and respond to those events quickly.
Mm-hmm. They come around and they put flags on them usually, so you can see it even when the snow gets deep. But we always either – someone in the neighborhood always tries to keep it cleared so it's more visible and accessible.
Accessible, even if it's visible, making it so it's accessible. Seconds count in those kind of situations. So, again, be good neighbors, be a good community. Make sure all the hydrants in your community are shoveled out. Those in your neighborhood, start with that.
If people have questions, they can always – call your office or get additional information on your website?
Exactly. At storycountyiowa.gov/EMA, we've got information on winter preparedness, and then they can give us a call at 515-382-7315.
Thank you for coming by and reminding us to get ready for winter.
It's something that's coming whether we want it or not.
That was Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management. I also asked Keith about the value of KHOI to him and his organization. So, Keith, one more thing before you go. You know, it's our fun drive. We're trying to get people to become members, to recognize the value that KHOI provides to the community and become members. So if KHOI didn't exist, you'd have to find other ways to get some of your important messages out to people.
Yes, there's since you're focused locally, we can address the local topics, unlike trying to get the message through one of the Des Moines or one of the other channels around here, both radio and television. You focus on the local story, and that gives us the opportunity to, again, feed back to the residents of Story County what's important to them.
Well, we appreciate you coming down here once a month, and hopefully our listeners do too, and they'll call in and become members. It's KHOI's fall membership drive. We are in full swing, and we're looking for 50 new members of the KHOI family. So all of you should consider contributing and think of all you learn by listening to Local Talk and donate now. You can do it online. Just go to the website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Or you can call 515-292-2878 or stop by and donate in person and meet some of the amazing KHOI volunteers. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Hallelujah by Sailor Jerry. And remember, this week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights from 7 to 8 p.m., you can hear live music, Pantorium sessions, special versions for our membership drive. 7 to 8 p.m. tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday night, live music at 410 Douglas. More information on that is online. Also, more information about a big event we have coming up, an evening with Nicholas Johnson, Media Under Siege. That's Friday, November 16th. Check out that on our website for more information. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.